Now, stop me if you've heard this one.
Ladies and gentlemen, we interrupt our program of dance music to bring you a special bulletin from the Intercontinental Radio News. At 20 minutes before 8 Central Time, Professor Farrell of the Mount Jennings Observatory, Chicago, Illinois, reports observing several explosions of incandescent gas occurring at regular intervals on the planet Mars. The spectroscope indicates the gas to be hydrogen and moving toward the Earth with enormous velocity. Professor Pearson of the observatory at Princeton confirms Farrell's observation and describes the phenomenon as, quote, like a jet of blue flame shot from a gun, unquote.
The year was 1938, and the Mercury Theater on the Air produced its version of the H.G. Wells classic, The War of the Worlds. The date was October 30th, the day before Halloween. Textbooks and news broadcasts to this day tell the story of how all of America panicked at the thought of being captured by Martians. Except very little of that happened. It was a story trumped up by newspapers because it made a great story, and others climbed on board for the ride. I'm Jim Grinstead, and today on Scams and Cons, we'll be talking about three frauds that continue to fool the world to this day. Perhaps the fact that a theater program was playing dance music could have tipped people off, but the stories don't mention that. Oh, and the show was announced and promoted during the week before its broadcast, and four times during the program it was mentioned that it was a radio play. Nothing more. There were tales of murders and suicides, calls from people who said spaceships had landed on their lawns, and they described the strange creatures that emerged. The thing is, most of America wasn't listening to the broadcast. They were listening to the Chase and Sanborn Hour on NBC, which featured ventriloquist Charlie Bergen and his dummy, Charlie McCarthy. It's also worth noting that radio was a new medium in those days. Newspapers felt threatened by it, much as they did when television arrived, and later when the internet emerged. Newspapers wanted to discredit radio and challenge whether it was a fit medium for news. The website Slate says that the newspaper trade publication editor and publisher said, and I quote, "The nation as a whole continues to face the danger of incomplete, misunderstood news over a medium which has yet to prove that is competent to perform the news job." Of course, this was after the newspapers were suckered into reporting the story as authentic.
Professor Morris of Macmillan University reports observing a total of 3 explosions on the planet Mars between the hours of 7:45 p.m. and 9:20 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. This confirms earlier reports received from American observatories. Now, nearer home, comes a special bulletin from Trenton, New Jersey. It is reported that at 8:50 p.m., a huge flaming object, believed to be a meteorite, fell on a farm in the neighborhood of Grover's Mill, New Jersey, 22 miles from Trenton.
Now, let's unpack this a bit. In 1676, the speed of light was determined. On average, it would take a little more than 12 minutes for light to get from Mars to Earth, more or less depending upon where the planets were in their orbits. Therefore, when observed, the so-called light flashes would have happened about 12 minutes earlier, and ignoring the need to slow down before crashing into the Earth, the spaceships could land another 12 minutes later. That would put us 24 minutes into a one-hour show that had already reported Martian landings. And how fortunate that the radio network was able to move reporters and transmission equipment to distant scenes so quickly. That'd be difficult even with today's technology. I could go on, but this wasn't a scam, nor was it intended to be. But if nothing else, scammers are opportunistic, and Wells himself saw an opportunity in a press conference.
It's only a little while ago that I again ran into some workers, some welfare workers, Quakers, and Red Cross people who had been up in the Black Hills of Dakota some 5 or 6 weeks after this broadcast, persuading the people to leave the mountains and go back home because Martians really hadn't come. All kinds of people reacted in all kinds of ways. For example, John Barrymore, the very famous American actor, this I know to be true, was listening to the broadcast and, although he was a friend of mine, ceased to identify me with the show and believed implicitly that America had fallen to the Martians. And hearing this on his radio, rushed out into his backyard where he kept 10 Great Danes in a kennels and released the dogs, giving them their freedom.
Contrast that with Welles' comments at the end of the original broadcast.
This is Orson Welles, ladies and gentlemen, out of character, to assure you that the War of the Worlds has no further significance than as the holiday offering it was intended to be. The Mercury Theater's own radio version of dressing up in a sheet and jumping out of a bush and saying boo. Starting now, we couldn't soap all your windows and steal all your garden gates by tomorrow night, so we did the best next thing. We annihilated the world before your very ears and utterly destroyed the CBS. You will be relieved, I hope, to learn that we didn't mean it and that both institutions are still open for business. So goodbye, everybody, and remember, please, for the next day or so, the terrible lesson you learned tonight. That grinning, glowing, globular invader of your living room is an inhabitant of the pumpkin patch, and if your doorbell rings and nobody's there, that was no Martian. It's Halloween.
I'm a summer guy. I'll be on the porch, enjoying a cool drink and reading. Doesn't get any better, unless someone else does the cooking. I'm not going to spend the day in fresh air only to eat processed foods. If I'm not eating fresh, I'm wasting one of the best seasons of the year. Fortunately, Factor comes to my rescue. They send fresh meals to me that can be cooked up in minutes. I can go back to the porch with a great meal and enjoy the sunset. I'm not into programmed diets. I like the chef's choice meals, but if I wanted keto, protein, vegan, or anything else, they can provide it. Premium meals could include steak, shrimp, broccolini, or asparagus. The meals come prepped and are customizable. You can get add-ons for breakfast, lunch, or snacks. And when I head out on vacation, Factor will pause my service until I get back. Plus, I love to grill, so I can choose one of Factor's meals during the week and fire up the charcoal on weekends. Be good to yourself. Enjoy the warm weather, great foods from Factor, along with some money-saving discounts I'm about to tell you about. Head to factormeals.com/scamsandcons50 and use code scamsandcons50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code scamsandcons50 at factormeals.com/scamsandcons50 to get 50% off your first box and 20% off your next box while your subscription is active. It's not surprising to hear Welles promoting the broadcast, but then AT&T decided to join the swarm.
Before we had 911, we had the switchboard operator. Telephone subscribers came to rely on the ever-present, reassuring voices that greeted them when they picked up their phone or dialed zero. When a fire broke out, or a child went missing, or a loved one became sick or injured, the operator was called to summon help. And it was not unusual to hear stories of great personal courage demonstrated by operators who would remain at the switchboards to warn others of impending danger rather than flee ahead of a threatening storm. So it should come as no surprise that on that Halloween Eve in 1938, when Martians were believed to have landed in New Jersey and a full-on invasion of Earth appeared to be underway, operators remained at their posts and did their best to calm the legions of distressed callers who reached out to them in genuine fear for their very lives.
Wow. And to think AT&T operators saved America from the Martians.
But people believed it. They really believed it that night. And I think of the ones who were begging us to get connections to their families, to their husbands, to mothers and fathers before the world came to an end so they could just tell them they loved them.
One man told me that people were jumping out of the windows and they were going to kill their families before the Martians could get them.
You see, it was not a case of answering a light and connecting them to somebody else. All they wanted was the operator.
I was just so concerned that I was going to help, be able to help all these people.
And one lady, probably minutes or many minutes after the onset, said they're as far as Chicago now. And I thought, if they're traveling that fast, they're going to be in Missoula before I get off duty.
I have the portrait of Dorian Gray. It's all he left me. It's exquisite. He is there as he was when Basil painted him in the wonder of his youth and beauty. In the attic room, they found a man in evening dress with a knife in his heart. He was withered, wrinkled, and loathsome to look at. It was not until they examined the rings on his bloated fingers that they recognized who it was.
To live forever. To never feel the grim reaper's grasp on your shoulder. To never age. To never experience the feeble memory, the aches of pain on your bones during your continual march to the grave. That was the goal of Dorian Gray, as you heard in the BBC production. But the burden was too great to bear as the image of his sins were reflected in his portrait. The burden was so great that he buried a knife in its heart, and in doing so, accepted both death and the misery that came with it. The book, The Picture of Dorian Gray, imagined a life that went on too long with few consequences, but that warning has not stopped people from seeking a fountain of youth, some elixir that would grant them eternal beauty of mind and body. While eternal life has been pursued for hundreds of years, in American history, it is focused on Ponce de Leon, who visited the New World with Columbus on his second voyage. It's been said that Ponce de Leon was seeking the fountain, but really, he wanted land where he could set himself up as the governor. His journey stopped near what is now St. Augustine, Florida, and arrow pierced de Leon after he landed, and before his death, he sent a letter back to Spain with no mention of the Fountain of Youth. Nevertheless, locals circulated the rumor that the fountain was de Leon's real goal in an effort to discredit him. Today, St. Augustine has continued to cash in on the false tales, and people flock to the city not only to enjoy its beauty, but to hear the stories that are told. But the quest for eternity continues, no matter how distant, no matter how far. Beyond the beauty creams, exercise programs, and all kinds of other dubious promises is the idea of cryonics, freezing all or part of your body until science can figure out how to cure what ails you and bring you back to life. Anyone who has frozen a steak for an extended period of time should see through this immediately. Freezing meat breaks down the cell walls, leaving the steak leaking and mushy and with far less flavor than it would have had you just cooked it and then frozen it. And even then, it's a bit mushy. If you want to be frozen, be sure to take a heavy blanket as you'll be experiencing temps from a negative 58 degrees Fahrenheit to negative 320 degrees depending upon the method. Come to think of it, you won't need a blanket, you'll be dead, but it will certainly be well below whatever room temperature is at 6 feet underground. According to the Cryonics Institute, and I'm quoting, "A Essentially, the concept is to buy time until technology catches up and is able to fully repair and restore the human body. Cryonicists are people who believe this future is not only possible, but highly probable, and who have decided to take action in the present for the chance of renewed life in the future. Cryonics Institute patients, currently cryopreserved at CI, include people from all walks of life and all ages. Chefs, students, secretaries, professors, and many others. We cannot guarantee this will happen in the future, but we are optimistic that our lifespans may be significantly, even radically, extended through cryonics. End quote. What size of a wallet will you need to be preserved? The Institute says its minimum is $28,000, but other companies may charge up to $200,000. If you want to preserve just your noggin, it can be around $80,000. As to why some people would even try such an unproven chance at immortality, 60 Minutes Australia asked some people to explain.
The fact is, for now, it's just not possible to bring a human back from the dead. But despite all the evidence, people like Michael Riskin put their faith in this dubious science. And he believes one day he'll be reunited with his wife.
In an ideal world, we would both be revived simultaneously with our memories and identities completely and be intact. And if I had to picture a perfect scenario, we would be sitting in a comfortable chair with our arms around each other and saying hello again.
I definitely hope that when cryonics comes up with a cure, that they will bring me back so I can go on and have a wonderful, happy life, which I enjoy very much.
If you want to make a different play for immortality, you might consider reincarnation.
In the early 2000s, a sensational news story took the world by storm. A young boy was proven by experts, so said the reports, to have lived a past life as a World War II fighter pilot who was shot down.
That was Brian Dunning of the website Skeptoid.com and his podcast episode on the topic. James Lanager was born in 1998 and from a very early age had a fascination with airplanes. His parents took him to museums, bought him toys and books, and introduced him to television and radio programs. The boy seemed to love them all. All that exposure practically guaranteed that he would know all the different types of military aircraft. And it reportedly happened by age 2. People were shocked. How could such a young boy know so much about these details unless he was a reincarnated pilot? His parents liked the story and they ran with it. So did the media. Little James would have nightmares and sometimes would repeat details from his dreams about a man crashing in a plane who was named James, and that plane was a Corsair, a fighter used in the Pacific. His parents reported that he even gave a partial name for the aircraft carrier he'd been on, the USS Natoma Bay. It was a head-scratcher, and the boy's father went to work trying to piece together what the boy had said. They discovered a pilot, James Houston Jr., that seemed to match the description. And in 2009, his parents wrote a book about their child's amazing abilities. James and his parents, Andrea and Bruce, sat down with Fox and friends after the book was published to talk about their experiences. Unfortunately, Fox didn't ask the most important question. Isn't this just a crock of shit? There's little doubt that the parents believed the story, but there's also substantial feedback from psychology experts that the family simply convinced itself that the story is true.
The body measures well over 10 feet in height, has a shoulder span of some 3 feet, 7-inch wide hands, and feet 19 and a half inches long.
This is the tale of the Cardiff Giant. It has scams, cons, sex, bidding wars, courtroom drama, resurrections, coffee tables, and, not surprisingly, P.T. Barnum. Our story began in June of 1868 after an argument between an Iowa Methodist preacher and George Hull, a tobacconist from New York State. The preacher was a Bible literalist, so when Genesis 6:4 says there were giants who not only walked the earth but lived within it, he endorsed it as fact. The preacher's interpretation did not set well with Hull, who was an atheist.
He wanted to pull one over on what he saw as an impressionable community of people, and also he saw it as an opportunity to make some money.
That's Mike Tamburine of the Farmers Museum in Cooperstown, New York. He's manager performing arts program at the museum, and that's where the original giant is today. Getting back to the 1800s, when George Hull got back to New York, he couldn't get the preacher's words out of his head.
He did some research and quarried this massive block of gypsum from Iowa and had it shipped via rail to Chicago, I believe, under the pretext that he was going to be making a statue of Abraham Lincoln. The giant was intended to be bigger, but he found out that he couldn't quite ship a block of gypsum that big, and so he had to like cut it in half. And had to be half the size that it was otherwise going to be. He shipped this to Chicago, and he had a whole bunch of people that he employed completely secretly, you know, covering up all the windows, dampening all of their tools. They could say nothing about the project to basically carve a giant naked man.
One important note, the carving was giant in many ways, and that means he was very well endowed. If that was a reflection of George Hull's anatomy, history doesn't record it. You'll find links to photos of the giant in the show notes.
They got it from the train station to his cousin, Stubb Newell's homestead, which who he had sort of roped into this as his subordinate. And under cover of night, they buried this 10-foot-long giant, 11-foot-long, whatever it is, 3 feet under the ground. And then they actually waited a year for the grass to grow back over it because they wanted to make it look like it was down there for a very long time. It was discovered when Stubb Newell was instructed to invite some people over to dig a well. So they started digging and they found it. It became sort of an overnight sensation. And Stubb Newell and George Hull didn't do a lot of marketing themselves. They let these two people that dug it up go out and start spreading the word. And, you know, soon the next day you had dozens and dozens of people coming. And then within a week, once you had thousands of people coming from out of state in some cases and across the country to see this, he started charging admission, which was initially 25 cents. You know, once it started to be like 10,000 people coming to see the giant, he doubled that. So initially 25 cents would have been about $5 today, and then $10 subsequently to go see the giant. And so that's the beginning of the story, at least, you know, how it was built and uncovered subsequently.
Ministers, some scientists, and educators proclaimed the giant was the greatest marvel ever discovered. There were also scientists who said from the start it was a fake.
Our lives were never the same after we learned our 21-year-old daughter, Kristen, was murdered by her ex-boyfriend. It's a parent's worst nightmare. How much did we really know about domestic violence back then? Clearly not enough. Now we know plenty. We know domestic violence, or DV, can happen to anyone. 1 in 3 women suffer physical violence at the hands of intimate partners during their lifetimes. 1 in 3. I'm Bill Mitchell, host of the When Dating Hurts podcast. And my interviews with DV counselors, law enforcement, and especially actual DV survivors give the pandemic of domestic violence the attention it deserves. The When Dating Hurts podcast. It's a series of lives being saved.
With all this hoopla, you wouldn't be surprised that P.T. Barnum showed up to see what all the hubbub was about. Barnum was never one to miss a chance to make money from life's oddities. He headed to Cardiff ready to buy the giant for $50,000 from Newell. Barnum was rejected, but Hull sold his share of the giant to showman David Hanum for $23,000. Adjusted for today's dollars, that's about $750,000. Barnum, not wanting to let facts get in the way of a quick buck, sent various people to see the giant, take notes, and make sketches. He then constructed his own giant. Now, if you're keeping track, and you should be, this is giant number 2. Barnum accused Hanum of making a fake, and Hanum turned to the courts to expose Barnum. In the meantime, Barnum continued to display his giant as the original, charging admission for the privilege to see it. Eventually, Hanum got his day in court. The giant didn't. The judge declined to hear the case unless the giant came before the court and offered proof of his originality. Now, Barnum is hauling the giant around the country, claiming it's real. George Hull and Stubb Newell have come clean, but people are still flocking in to see the giant, so they continue to collect money for admission, taxi rides, pies, and probably other things. The con continues. Eventually, the crowd stopped visiting the giant, leaving Hanum and Stubb to decide what to do, since the giant's value dropped like a rock. They sold it to a collector. It was sold and resold again to various collectors over time. It ended up with Iowa publisher Gardner Coles Jr., who used the well-endowed giant for a coffee table, no doubt leaving his guests wondering just where to put the donuts served with the coffee. But there was a third giant left to come, and maybe a fourth. You'll have to decide that one on your own. The next part of our tale takes us back to Iowa, where the story began over an argument between Hull and a Methodist preacher. The gypsum used to make the original giant came from Fort Dodge, Iowa. That site was chosen for its gypsum because it had streaks that resembled veins. Since they didn't have the money to buy the original, they created their own. A sculptor was hired for $2,100 and a new giant emerged. It remains at the Fort Dodge Frontier Village. That leaves the question of what happened to P.T. Barnum's giant. Jeremy Yagoda, son of Marvin Yagoda, says his father bought Barnum's giant at a Sotheby's auction. It was previously owned by Dr. James W. Smith, Jr., who had a very large circus collection. Jeremy said the giant is on display at Marvin's Marvelous Mechanical Museum in Farmington Hills, Michigan. It is belief that scammers need to succeed. George Hull had inspired that belief once, so he moved west to make a sequel. The Cardiff Giant, The Resurrection of the Scam. Hull looked up his old friend P.T. Barnum and proposed a new giant, the Solid Muldoon. Barnum agreed to invest $2,000 for 75% of the company. Barnum brought an associate named William Connett, so Hull and Connett were dispatched to Beulah, Colorado. The two picked out a site and began salting it with so-called fossils. Connett's son ran a newspaper in Colorado Springs, and it printed stories about the finds made by a local collector. Connett Sr. had already buried the 7.5-foot-tall statue. They billed it as the missing link in human evolution. The Denver Library's account describes the effigy with extremely long, over 4-foot-long arms, almost comically oversized feet, and a curled 4-inch tail. The finished creation was beaten with needles embedded in lead to give the appearance of pores. When fired in a kiln, the mortar became suitably hardened and took on a brownish tone. Hull put a human skeleton within the mold to add credibility that it was a petrified person. Barnum had arranged to be in the state at the time the Solid Muldoon was discovered, and he rushed to the site to see it. He offered $20,000 for it and charged audiences 50 cents each to view it. The Colorado Chieftain newspaper dubbed the figure the Solid Muldoon, based on Edward Harrigan's Irish tune whose lyrics include,
There goes Muldoon. He's a solid man. The excitement didn't last long, and a disgruntled investor told the world about the fake. It's not known what happened to the Muldoon, but there's a marker where the figure is supposedly reburied. Is this where the giant's impact ends? No, the con lives on, continuing to rake in money. Ty Davis, an artist from Syracuse, New York, brought the giant's money-making techniques into modern times. He created a replica of the giant that went on display in 2011. Are we up to five giants? I lose track. The original giant was said to have drawn 100,000 people to Cardiff. At 25 cents each, that works out to $25,000 in $1860. Today, that would be about $822,000. Add to that the money Bartom made off his copy, the money that changed hands among collectors, and what all versions have generated since then. And the giants still aren't done. They still draw crowds into museums and anywhere else some marketer decides to cash in on the legend. And this is where the story and the scam ends. For now, the Cardiff Giant scam has continued for more than 130 years. And it's not done yet.
If you enjoy the podcast and want to support it, please consider doing so via Patreon. For just $10 a month, you'll help us keep the lights on so we can continue to create great content for you. You can sign up at patreon.com, that's patreon.com, then search for Scams and Cons. There'll be a link in the show notes. We'll be back in 2 weeks. Thanks for listening.
Something is creeping, don't follow it down.
Let me introduce you to Barry Clue, an authorised financial advisor from New Zealand and a very special kind of stain on humanity.
He was a very knowledgeable young guy.
He was a registered financial advisor.
Type of guy that was bending over backwards to help you.
Now, you could be forgiven for thinking that Barry sounds like a great guy, and you'd be right. Well, right up until the point when you're wrong.
It was all fictitious.
You stole from my son, who has a disability.
Chris never knew. He died believing that we're all taken care of.
A psychopath is somebody who lacks empathy, acts impulsively. I think there's a strong case that Barry might be all of those things, actually.
To find out how Barry Clue stole over $15 million from 81 victims, subscribe to Clueless, The Long Con. That's Clueless, spelt Klooghless.